You may know that the Bible has been subjected to all sorts of different kinds of analysis. People have looked at it linguistically, geographically, anthropologically, and mathematically. And this morning I want to begin with a little biblical math. The rabbis have determined that there are about four times as many verses describing the building of the tabernacle as there are describing the creation of the world. Now, this is what is known in modern parlance as counterintuitive, right? You would assume that the world is more complicated to make than a box. But, of course, the Bible says, "You shall make me a tabernacle, v'shachanti b'tocham," which means I'll dwell among you and within it. And so the rabbis say, you see, it is harder for people to build a place for God than it is for God to build a place for people. So God can make a world in which we can dwell, but for us to make a space for God, that's not so easy. Anyone knows that who's ever preached on Parshat Truma, because Truma means what? Giving. Just try to fundraise for a place for God, and you know that sometimes it's easier to create the world than it is to build a place where God can dwell. That's okay, I'm not going to fundraise this morning. I just thought I'd mention it. And the reason that I bring it up is that what the Israelites had in order for God to dwell among them was this ark. And that was essentially it. When you wanted to know what was the focus of the Jewish people, where did their dreams dwell, where did their hopes for God live, they had to point to something that could actually be carried by a couple of people. That was all they had. They were outside the land. And the entirety of the promise lived in that small space that promised them that one day they would enter the land. That is essentially what the Aron Kodesh promised. But it promised beyond that, that when they left the land, they weren't leaving God. Because the remarkable thing about the Jewish tradition was the way in which it created this portable sanctuary. So no matter where Jews dwelt, as long as they carried the contents of the Ark with them, as long as they had the Torah, as long as they had each other, God dwelt in their midst and in their hearts. And so for thousands of years, Jews read this parasha, and they identified with the Israelites who carried the ark through the wilderness because they too were in the wilderness. They may have called that wilderness Poland, and they may have called it Babylonia, and they may have called it Persia, and they may have called it America, but it was still essentially the wilderness because they didn't have a home. And even if you are comfortable in someone else's home, as you know, it's different when you're home. The air is different in your home. And so as the Israelites carried that box through the wilderness, they dreamed that one day they would come home. And it is a long story of exile and homecoming for the Jewish people. Last night, to the Friday Night Live group, I told the story of Ben Gurion, when after the establishment of the State of Israel, he was speaking to a group of Iraqi schoolchildren who had just come in the first waves of Aliyah from Iraq. And he said to them, "Do you know who the first Zionist was?" So one child said Herzl, and one child said Weizmann, and one child, who was probably a little smarter than the rest, said Ben-Gurion. And Ben-Gurion said, no. The first Zionist was an Iraqi Jew. His name was Abraham. And what he was saying to them is, your story didn't begin yesterday, and it didn't begin last week, and it didn't begin last year. It began thousands of years ago, and it's the same story. We go back that far. Our story is that long. And we have carried the Mishkan through every land on earth in the hopes that one day we would be able to bring it where it belonged, back home. And that, in a sentence, is the story of our people. But here is the second half of that same story. Every time the Jews have succeeded in going home, a number of Jews have decided to live outside of home. This is not the first time that Jews have lived outside of the state of Israel when they possessed the state of Israel. It happened in the time of David and in the time of Solomon, and even in the time of Moses. When the Jews first walked through the desert and entered the land of Israel, there were 2.5 tribes that decided to stay on the far side of the Jordan. Right? Reuven, Gad, v'chatzi Menashe, and half of Menashe. And you know what Moses said to them? He didn't say to them, how dare you not live in the land when I have given my whole life and God has promised you this land. That wasn't his message to the tribes. What Moses said to them is, okay, you've decided you don't wish to dwell with the Mishkan in Jerusalem. That's your choice. But there is a choice that you don't have. The choice that you do not have is you are not permitted to hold back while we're fighting for the land. You can live outside the land, but when your brothers and sisters in the land need you, you have to be there. Since they have to fight for the land, so do you. And you are not permitted to stand back and watch them fight and enjoy your life outside in the wilderness. Now, I would love to tell you, and you would love to hear, and we would all love to know that the fight is over. That we no longer have to fight for the land. And so we, who are Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe, we who are the tribes that live outside the land, we're done. Or alternately, it would be lovely to tell you that really all the land of Israel needs is, after Shabbat, write a check. But you'll notice that Moses didn't say to Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh, all we really need are your contributions. Send us a few sheep, the first fruits of your plantings, and we'll call it square. What Moses said is, you have to fight for the land if you're not going to live in the land. And so you have to ask yourself, what does that mean today? Does it mean contributing to Israel? Yes, but that's not fighting for the land. Neither you nor I are going to put on army uniforms and fight with guns. And in fact, there is a fight that we can conduct that ultimately will be more important for us to do than fighting with guns. Because no matter how much money you give to the land of Israel, Israel will not rise or fall with the contributions of American Jews. The state won't go under because American Jews haven't given them enough money. Let me tell you what you can give Israel that will make a decisive difference to the future of the state and of the Jewish people. We are American citizens. America is not the only, but it is by far the most important ally that the state of Israel has in this world. I shudder to think what would happen tomorrow if America didn't support the land of Israel. If you want to fight for Israel, then you have to fight for American support for Israel. And I have a way for you to do it. This is not theoretical. In fact, this morning I have two ways, or even three ways, for you to do it. And I'm going to mention all three of them chronologically. The first way you show the activity, of course, of the American Jewish community is tomorrow at Super Sunday for Federation, to show up, to contribute, to make calls, and to give. The second way you do it is on February 26th, when there is an event at Wilshire Theater live for Sderot, and we have brochures outside, where the children of Sderot, which every single day is the target of Qassam rockets across the border, children who are frightened to go to school because the rockets begin, surprise, surprise, the moment the children leave for school at 8 a.m. in the morning. And they stop then after the children are back home safely. And by the way, you can see some of the children's drawings in our hall, where a child shows a picture. One of the pictures is a child home with his mother or father, and a rocket is coming through the roof. On February 26th, we can show up as a community and support this government, Israel government-sponsored event, where everybody who is coming, including a well-known Israeli singer and children of Sderot and the local officials, including our mayor and other government officials, will gather to show our support for the people of Sderot and also to get the American media to pay attention to what is going on in the city of Sderot, because if you don't know about it, then it hasn't made the front pages of the papers in the evening news. And then you can join us in June. Because June 2nd to 4th, Sinai Temple is taking a delegation of people to the AIPAC conference, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And in Washington, we're going to go to that conference, which draws 3,000 to 4,000 Jews from across the country. We're going to speak to senators, to congressmen, listen to leading members of the administration, and I am quite sure to whatever presidential candidates remain standing at that point. And we are going to demonstrate to them that we care. Because if you think that they don't pay attention to how many people come specifically to conferences where Israel is on the agenda, that they don't measure the American Jewish support of the land of Israel not only by the checks you write but by your presence, then you are sadly mistaken. They know it's easier to write a check than it is to get on a plane. And they measure the intensity of our commitment by the intensity of our effort. If you're there, you count. If you're not, you don't. Every time there is a march in Washington, what's the first thing you read? How many people showed up? There were this many people at the march, that many people at the march. And when a politician stands up in front of a conference of Jews supporting Israel, how many people he or she sees, that matters. There are mitzvot in our tradition. I can think only of two, and I believe there are only two, although there may be more, that have a special status in the Jewish tradition. One is leshev basukah, being in the sukkah. The other is the mitzvah of mikvah, of the ritual bath. And why are they different? Because they require your entire body. You light candles with your hand. You make a bracha with your mouth. But when you go into the sukkah, it requires all of you. I and mine, wrote the poet Whitman, convinced by presence. In other words, by being there. And you know very well, you can talk on the phone to someone. You can write them 1,000 emails, but it's not the same as spending 5 minutes in their presence. In an age of virtual communication, there's still nothing like being there. There is nothing like walking into the congressman's office and saying, this is who I am, this is where I came from, and this is what I believe and care for. You know, in your business, in your life, that one person's presence matters more than 100 letters, 1,000 letters. That the face of the person in front of you, that stays in your mind. That the story someone tells you, that doesn't leave you. When you come with us, you get to tell your story. You get to be there. You may live outside the land, but you fight for the land. That is our task. And in fact, it's the price that we pay for being able to live in America when other people are living in Israel and living in Sderot and fighting on the border. That is our job. Now, if I could, I'd get the whole congregation to go. But we should take hundreds. We should. I mean, really, I'm giving you enough advance warning. It's not till June. June 2nd to June 4th. It's 2 days out of your life. And you know, and I know, that on the plane back, you're going to say, I had an amazing experience. There is no chance that you will, on June 5th, regret having gone to the conference. That you'll say, you know what? Should have stayed home and watched television. No chance. But you have to overcome the inertia of doing nothing. And the way you do that is the same way that Moses asked of Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh, which is to recognize the enormous gifts that you have been given and to feel like you owe something back. To remember the bereaved parents and the fighting children in Israel and remember that you owe them something. And to know that nothing you can do for the state of Israel matters as much as ensuring that the steadfast support of our country, the United States, remains as it is now and never wavers. There is one superpower left in the world, and God forbid 1,000 times that superpower shouldn't stand behind the state of Israel. This is the 60th year of the state of Israel, and even more important for our purposes, it's an election year. This is the year people are listening. And if you're quiet when people are listening, then it doesn't matter if you shout when they've shut their ears. This is the time. This is the year. Those of you who have questions, first of all, there are brochures outside, and also you can ask me, you can ask Jan Zakowski, if you don't know Jan, a past president of the synagogue, you can ask, who is holding up the brochure, you can ask our current president, Kurt Smallberg, who is also going along with Cantor Gold and along with me, and I hope all of you. In the end, after all, the Mishkan was only built because one day there would be a temple. The idea wasn't that we would build this portable sanctuary and it would stay portable forever. The idea was that one day we would return to our home and it would rest. And so would we. Well, we have returned to our home, but it is not yet the time to rest. We have not yet accomplished what our sages and prophets promised. We do not yet sit each of us under a vine and fig tree, planted in our land, never more to be plucked up. But if we are strong enough, if we are steadfast enough, if we are passionate enough, and if we are loud enough, that day will come. So please, sign up, come with us, demonstrate not only to our brothers and sisters in Israel, but to our brothers and sisters and politicians and friends in Washington, that we will not be silent, we will not be still, that Am Yisrael Chai, the nation of Israel, is still alive. Shabbat Shalom.